Check engine, ABS, or maintenance light on? Take the guesswork out of your warning lights with O'Reilly Veriscan. The service is free and provides a report with solutions verified by ASE-certified master technicians. And if you need help, we could recommend a shop for you. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of Chronicles, where this time we're going to be talking about The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells. And here, this time to talk the story through with me, is the future King of Mars himself, Bo. How are you, sir?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, really good. Really, thanks for coming on to talk all about such an iconic novel.
Yeah, no, I'm happy to. It's one of my favourites. I've read it a number of times.
Yeah.
I've reread it. Well, actually, re-listened to the audiobook over the weekend.
Right.
So it's fresh in my mind. I actually haven't seen the Tom Cruise version, or I watched a bit of it and then abandoned it. I wasn't interested.
Yes.
But the original book is superb.
Well, I'm personally of the opinion, being, you know, a prudish purist, that it shouldn't really be set, The War of the Worlds shouldn't really be set in any era other than Victorian England. Right. The story works best in Victorian England, partly because it was responding to a particular moment in British history. You know, it's responding to the British Empire at the height of its power during the Pax Britannica, the 1890s, when there was a feeling of real national confidence in the air. Now, you suppose you could say that about America, you know, 2000, when the film was trying to, but it's just not the same. It's in order to work best, it's got to be kept in the time period it was meant to be in.
Yeah, no, definitely. The original book is very, very, very firmly set in Southeast England, or in and around the Greater London region.
Yes.
And it's interesting because I'm from the Southeast. And so loads of the, like the original alien invasion lands at Woking,
yeah,
of all places, that's sort of west of London. A lot of it is west of London, but he goes on to talk about Kent and like Chelmsford.
Southend, Shoeburyness.
Yeah. So anyway, that's my part of the world. So when I first read it, I don't know how old I was, 16 or 18 or something like that, probably, I think, when I first read it. And I'm like, this is, I know all these places.
Right, yeah.
Like you mentioned, quite a few places in central London that I know. So it's in a really specific time and place. It's set. And yeah, that's the original thing. Why mess with that?
Absolutely. And I learned as well that apparently he, in order to sort of get the story really clear in his mind, H.G. Wells went on a bike ride from Woking, because he was living in Woking at the time when he wrote it. And so he went on the bike ride through, you know, through Weybridge, through Shepperton, into London, around Putney, and then obviously through down into Essex Way, in order to really, and I'll what I'll do is I'll ask in edit to get a map put up of the Martian warpath and where it goes through, because it's one of those ones, you know, because of his style of realism, where he writes about everything in such minute, realistic detail as to the nature and character of these little villages from the home counties and, of course, the main capital of London, that you really, it adds this layer of believability to really obviously outlandish, you know, the idea of Martians coming from space and conquering London at the height of the British Empire. And so, you know, using that style of realism, it grounds it all and makes it much more believable in the reader's mind.
And it's very, very deliberate. It just didn't happen to do that. I actually, when I was listening to it at the weekend, I did think to myself of, I'll probably never do it, but of following that course. People must have done it before.
Oh, I'm sure.
The course of the aliens. But yeah, it like goes from like out in Woking, like through places like Hampton Court and Richmond and then to Primrose Hill and on and on.
Yeah.
It'd probably be a really nice journey. If the weather was nice, it'd probably be really nice.
Probably.
But it's very, very deliberate because he was writing for a sort of middle class audience, the type of people that would live in West London or Surrey. They are sort of his audience. They are his people, if you like.
I mean,
he was, one of the things I think we should say early on is that he was extremely famous in his own lifetime, right? He was a massive bestseller in his own lifetime. I mean, his breakthrough was The Time Machine.
Of course.
And everything after that was, I mean, so I've heard some people say he was one of the most famous people in the world. He was absolutely literary royalty. Even by the time this, certainly after War of the Worlds came out.
Yes, which was, for those who might not know, it first came out in a serialized form from 1893 to 1895. And then it was published as one single physical story in 1898.
Right. And that's another thing to mention, isn't it, to begin with, I think, is that it's obviously of its time.
Yeah.
So, like, it's pre the very, very, very late 19th century, sort of higher Victorian period, late Victorian period. Men couldn't fly yet. The Wright brothers hadn't done their thing yet.
Right.
So at one point, for example, he talks about the secret of flight.
Yes.
That men will learn the secret of flight from the aliens. It's like, oh, yeah, he couldn't in 1895 or whatever, we didn't fly yet.
No.
Well, in balloons, but not powered flight.
Sure.
And there's all sorts of things like that. There's a few things where he mentions something about various things about Mars and things about Venus even, where we now know that's not true, that's not correct. But they didn't know that yet in the late 19th century. There's a number of things like that. I mean, H.G. Wells is a really interesting life, period of his life. So he was born in the 1860s, 1866, I think, and died when he was about 80-odd, just after the war, World War II.
Yeah, lived through many really important historical events, saw a lot,
a lot of change. And he was one of those people who would have been, was, had his formative years and his early adulthood in sort of the classic high Victorian period, but then lived through World War One, saw the world, what it was like before and after World War One. And most people say that lived through that, that it was night and day. It was like, you, if you didn't know what the world was like pre-1914, you can never really know. And then even at the end of his life, he saw nukes, right?
Right.
In a year or so before he died, he would have seen Hiroshima and stuff, and fulfilling a lot of the sort of themes he talks about, that science can go crazy, that men need to be careful about his science, because he might blow up the world or kill himself one way or another.
Yes.
And he saw it sort of almost happen.
Yeah, Nagasaki, definitely as devastating as a Martian attack with the heat rays and black smoke. So one thing I suppose it's also important to mention, just in terms of the style of novel that it is that it comes from a specific, not that all novels ever written about this were fit into this particular time period, but there was a particular time period from about 1870, the end of the Franco-Prussian War, till about World War One, which was known as invasion literature, which was responding to a particular anxiety at the time in Britain about the possibility of invasion that had come after the sort of startling success of Prussia against France, and the genuine militaristic might of them. And that if the Germans so wanted to, this might, this anxiety, you know, might become a reality. And one of the novels that first responded to this was written in 1871, by a British general called George Tompkins Chesney, who wrote a novel called The Battle of Dorking, in which a very non-specific people who spoke German attacked Dorking, and the people of Dorking were cut off from everyone else outside.
Oh, is this with loads of blimps?
Yes.
Yeah.
And this, and so the War of the Worlds, about, you know, responding about, well, 24 years later, is still a part of that heritage. But H.G. Wells obviously brings in a much more science fiction spin on it, being, and that's another thing, when you talked about the fact that he wrote The Time Machine and, you know, Martians coming from space, he was the first person to create these ideas. The very idea of, we take, you know, Time Machine, Back to the Future, you know, Avengers, all these sorts of things now, like, oh yeah, time travel, that's just a thing that we associate with science fiction. Well, he came up with it. He came up with the time machine.
So yeah, a number of things you've said there. So responding to that straight away, the reason why H.G. Wells is, it's still brilliant in and of itself, standing alone. But the reason why he's so pivotal is because, yeah, lots of themes that he talks about, he was the first one. It's odd to think in our world of not having time travel stories, but the time machine was the first one, apparently. Apparently, no one ever wrote about time travel before then. And lots of other things that he did first. The other thing, I think Jules Verne wrote a story about Germans sending like a whole fleet of blimps, or what do they call them? Dirigibles. What's the German word for them?
Zeppelin.
Zeppelins. Fleets of Zeppelins across the Atlantic to attack New York. This idea that they sort of knew or thought that future wars would have aerial bombing of cities. But they hadn't actually, again, the Wright brothers hadn't actually built any powered planes yet. But you did have blimps.
Yes.
So, I suppose one of the main things, not just, there's one line in there, isn't there, actually, where he says something about he's surprised that civilization didn't wake up to the fact that they've been invaded right away. And even though like a day or two into it, London is still just hasn't really woken up to the fact that it's happening.
Yeah.
And he said that if the news had come across that the Germans had mobilized, there'd be much more panic in the streets.
Yes.
And that's interesting because that's like, you know, 20 years before World War One, people, it was still already in the public consciousness that the Germans might do something like that.
Right.
That's an interesting sort of insight into the last years of the 19th century. And I suppose one of the biggest things is not just the fear of the Germans invading or anyone invading, but the theme, I'm sure you're going to talk about it, the theme of the Martians being imperialists or colonizers even.
Yeah, it's kind of an allegory for imperialism.
Because H.G. Wells was sort of fairly anti-imperialist. He was something of a red, a little bit of a socialist. It didn't consume him or his writing particularly, but it is there.
Yes.
And he was sort of an early proto-feminist. It's a bit strong. Nothing like third or fourth wave feminism, but you know, Victorian style, very, very early feminist type person.
Yes.
So
certainly example, liked women.
Yeah, yeah. he loved the women's. But this idea that certain colonial powers would go around the world and sometimes be quite brutal. So there's one line in there, isn't it, where he talks about the Tasmanians, mentions the Tasmanians.
Yes.
And apparently in real life, that was something that played on his consciousness. Because we went to Tasmania, Tassie, little island off the bottom of Australia, and unspeakable things happened to the indigenous people there.
Yes.
And apparently one time he was on a walk with his brother, and his brother put the seed in his head. He said, imagine if some alien creatures came down that was as more advanced to us than we are to Tasmanian Aboriginals, and they treated us the way we treated them. Imagine that. And anyway, that's one tiny little seed, one tiny little a bit of motivation to write War of the Worlds, apparently. It's great, isn't it?
Oh, it's fantastic.
It's a real page-turner.
It is.
Some books, even very, very famous books, they're a bit of a chore, particularly 19th century books, can be a bit of a chore, right? Dickens, as good as he is, sometimes it's quite slow.
You have to trust his process. You have to trust the payoff with
Dickens. H.G. Wells is just straight in and you're hooked. Or I am. Most people are.
No, I am too.
It's great, yeah. You can tell actually from whoever wrote the screenplay, I don't know if it's actually Jeff Wayans himself, wrote the narration for the 70s show, how they've abridged that opening line.
Yep.
I've remembered verbatim the Richard Burton thing. Shall I do it?
I'll go for it, yeah.
I shall do my Burton.
I should have handed it over to you, really. I feel bad now.
So that goes, it might not be 100% verbatim, but it should be quite close. He says, okay.
On the spot.
He goes, nobody would have believed that in the closing years of the 19th century, human affairs were being watched from the timeless worlds of space. Nobody could have dreamed that we were being scrutinized as somebody with a microscope might study the creatures that swarm and multiply in a drop of water. Few men even considered the possibility of life on other planets. And yet, from across the Gulf of Space, minds immeasurably superior to our own regarded our Earth with envious eyes. And slowly and surely, they drew their plans against us.
Okay, so what we're going to do now is we're going to edit out my entire reading of that, and we're just going to keep that magnificent. That was terrific.
To make a short out of that.
Yeah. You've been practicing that in the mirror, haven't you?
Well, no, there's a few things. When I was a kid, I was taught that you should learn things by rote.
Yeah.
Just a number of things. Anything you like.
Yeah, it's a great skill.
Anything that you, any little monologue or any little speech from a TV or film or anything, you learn, or a poem.
Yes.
Or a paragraph from a famous book, a bit of Shakespeare.
Well, I've got the whole of Once More Under the Breach, that whole monologue. Right. I know it. It's there.
Yeah, I've got a couple of dozen different things that I know off by heart like that.
And that's a great one to have.
A few bits of Shakespeare, a couple of shorter poems. And it's really, really good, especially when you're younger. If you sort of force a, if you've got like a 10-year-old, 12-year-old, 13-year-old kid, force them to do that a bit. And you, they'll remember it forever.
Yeah.
Because most of these things I learned when I was much younger. And it used to be a cornerstone of education to force children to learn things by rote. And it fell out of favour many, many years ago because, frankly, dumb people don't like doing it or can't do it. So it fell out of favour to teach kids to do that.
Sure.
But in fact, it's a brilliant tool for learning, comprehension, memory.
Yeah, totally.
All sorts of things. So I've had that in my head for 25 years,
it
30
shows.
Years probably.
It shows. Okay. It was brilliant. I love that. What a great thing to witness. So I suppose, but from that as well, to go back to a point you were saying earlier, as the story moves on, so the first cylinder is fired from Mars and it shoots down in a Horsell Common near Woking, right, that level of detail. And like you're saying, people just go about their day. He talks about the fact that, you know, just the teenagers walk down the street flirting with one another, students are still at school studying, you know, mums and dads are putting the children to bed. You know, he also talks about the fact that, so that the narrator himself, he doesn't have a name, of course. You know this, but, you know, just for people who are listening, it's all done from first-person narration. And even though there is a second point of view, which is the narrator's brother, it's obviously told in a style in which the brother has survived the events, told the narrator, and then the narrator has chronicled them as an eyewitness account of, because the narrator chronicles what happens in the home counties and around Woking and the rural villages, and the brother chronicles what actually happens in London, in the big city. And so you get the point of view of what the effect of the Martian attack has on both the rural and metropolitan aspects of British society.
There's a whole section in the middle where it cuts away. This is what happened to my brother.
Yeah.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's really good. And it's all in the first person, which makes it quite immediate as well, doesn't it? Makes it slightly more easier to read. Harry was saying the other day that many, many books aren't written in the third person, sort of omniscient narrator anymore, because the modern reader doesn't like that as much. But anyway, War of the Worlds is basically in the first person. Which makes it much more immediate.
So then, obviously, some things to talk about is that the British men, you know, obviously the military comes in and security to try and figure out what's going on. And the cylinder is, of course, piping hot. And all the time you can hear inside it this screwing noise as the Martians are starting to figure out how to come out of the cylinder. They have to wait for it to cool and then they start coming out. And the first thing, of course, that any civilized people do is they try to communicate with the Martians and check whether or not they're hostile or whether or not they've come in peace. And, of course, the Martians are entirely here as a matter of conquest.
Yeah.
Which goes back to what we were saying about the H.G. Wells making the allegory towards colonialism and the Tasmanians. This isn't about trade. This isn't about trade routes or commerce. This is about sole just domination of another planet.
One thing I'll say before we even get there's a big set or fairly long section at the beginning before even the first cylinder lands where he sort of talks about and describes sort of normal life a bit and where he's just the writer, the narrator is a writer, isn't he?
Mm.
Well, it's H.G. Wells, basically.
It's basically
H.G. Wells. And he sort of describes a little bit sort of the mundane life, and the astronomers had noticed sort of something going on Mars.
Mm.
Like the one or two astronomers that actually sort of keep eyes on Mars at all times had noticed some sort of plumes of smoke and things. And they assume that there's, later when they realise there's cylinders or something heading towards them, they assume some sort of giant gun has been fired, some sort of giant cannon has fired these cylinders at Earth.
Mm.
But even though it's sort of mentioned in a tiny little corner of the Telegraph somewhere or something, the whole world doesn't care about it. Mm. Most people don't know about it at all.
Yeah.
And he's got his friend Ogilvy, the astronomer.
Yes.
And he goes up and he looks through the telescope at Mars one night before they've landed.
Yeah.
And sees with his own eyes one of these giant puffs of smoke on the surface of Mars.
Mm.
But yeah, once they land, you know, the people of England are sort of just curious and think there probably won't be, there won't even be any men inside it.
Mm.
It's probably not even hollow. And if there are, when it does appear that there are creatures inside, when they finally unscrew it, they don't immediately assume they're going to be hostile. But they just are,
yeah.
Right? They're just immediately murderous,
yes,
and terrifying. And the description—I mean, H.G. Wells's descriptions are great. There's a reason why he's considered one of the all-time greatest writers, or certainly sci-fi writers. He's probably my second or third favorite sci-fi writer, after Arthur C. Clarke and Jules Verne.
Mm.
In fact, I put Jules Verne third and H.G. Wells second just because of the English thing.
Right.
Anyway.
Based.
Yeah. You can't put a Frenchman above H.G. Wells.
No, we can't.
Do that.
Not at Lotus Eaters, no.
But his descriptions, like, for example, the first descriptions of the aliens, like the horror of it, before they've even done anything particularly evil or murderous.
Yeah.
Just the first time he lays eyes on them, there's like all the descriptions of how it makes your skin crawl, and they're sort of truly alien and weird. And yeah, it paints a good picture for you.
If you enjoyed this piece of premium content from the Lotus Eaters, head to our website where you can find more.